The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got an awesome show for you. I hope you're enjoying your 4th of July weekend, Independence Day. It's a great country that we do live in, and I'm just going to say I am proud to be American. And we participate, the Finman family. It's been a tradition to participate in the Oak Park 4th of July parade, all that kind of good stuff. Barbecued hot dogs. Yep, we're into it. Kosher, of course. In this half hour of the show, we're going to feature an interview with Yochanan Petrovsky Stern, who is a professor of history at Northwestern University in Chicago. Wrote a book, The Golden Age Shtetl, A New History of Jewish Life in East Europe. This is actually the definitive what you need to know about the shtetl life. We're going to talk about that. That's really cool. That's way cool. We got terrific music for you throughout the show. The portion of the week is the portion of Pinchas, one of my actually favorite portions. I suppose if you ask me what's my favorite portion, I'd probably tell you whatever portion we're reading now. And that's in the book of Numbers, chapter 24 and following. Hopefully have time for a Hasidic story. We didn't tell the story I wanted to tell last week, so maybe hopefully we'll get to it this week. It's my favorite Hasidic story, parable. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. The burnt body of a kidnapped Arab teenager was found in the forest north of Jerusalem. The killing is not being considered as retaliation for the murder of the three Israeli teenagers. Police are considering this a criminal attack, most likely by another Arab. Qassam rocket fired by Gaza Arab terrorists struck a house in Sderot. Miraculously, no one was injured. The house is being used for a summer day camp, and children were about to come to the building for their day in camp just a few minutes after the attack. Arab rioters damaged three Jerusalem light rail stations. It will be months before the stations can be reopened. Right now, Arab neighborhoods of Jerusalem are the only ones affected by the Arab rioters, because the ones in the Jerusalem neighborhood were not affected, and the trains can go there, but they can't go to this one. So they shot themselves in the foot. Five Israeli police officers were fired for the handling of an emergency call that came in from one of the abducted teens on June 12th. The police officers on duty initially considered the 10:12 p.m. call a prank. It was not until 4 a.m. that IDF forces were alerted to the kidnapping and unfortunately realized that it was because their abductors knew that the police were being called that the kids were killed almost immediately. The Israeli Air Force bombed nine terrorist targets in Gaza overnight, a weapons manufacturing site in northern Gaza, a weapons manufacturing site and terrorist center in central Gaza, and three concealed rocket launchers and three terrorist centers in southern Gaza. They've been back and forth all week with this bombing back and forth and rockets from Gaza. The Israel police are searching for a woman in northern Israel since Thursday after she made a distress call and said she was being attacked. Helicopters were used in the search, are being used in the search, and we'll keep you posted on this one. And finally, Israel issued 500 work permits to Jordanians to work in hotels in Eilat. The 500 would join about 1,000 workers who already are employed in Israeli hotels. The workers replace African illegals who had been sent back to their home countries. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000. Or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. We have online with we're with Professor Dr. Yochanan Petrovsky Stern. He's written a book called The Golden Age Shtetl, A New History of Jewish Life in Eastern Europe. How are you today, Yochanan?
I'm doing fine, Rabbi Herschel.
That's great. Good to hear.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it is our pleasure. Whenever you had a fascinating topic, then, I mean, I'm on the air now for 18 years, and I have never done a show about the shtetl, but I have always wanted to do a show about the shtetl, and I didn't know who to contact. But
so you just lost 18 years for nothing.
That's, well, it's, I'm looking at it as we've gained another 18 years to go on.
Okay.
So, the listening, it says the preparation is also very important. So we've been preparing for 18 years to get to this point. Okay, right. Enough jocularity. There's a lot of mythology behind the shtetl. And in talking to you, you said this, that your book takes the fiddler off the roof. There's a lot of mythology about how great the shtetl was, and there's a lot of mythology about how awful the shtetl was. So before we do anything else, just for our listening audience, let's back up way back, and let's describe what is, let's define, what is a shtetl as opposed to, say, a shtut or a dorf or some other place where people in Europe live?
Oh, okay, Rabbi Herschel. I thought that we should start perhaps with the memories, with the very bad and very nice memories of the shtetl, but we can get to this point a little bit later. Now, what is the shtetl and how it is different from the shtot, which is a city, and from a dorf, which is a village? According to my investigation and my very careful reading of the 18th and 19th century contemporary documents in Polish, Ukrainian, Russian, and other languages, the shtetl emerges as a Jewish version of what they call in Polish miasteczko, and what do they call in Ukrainian mistechko, and what they call in Russian miasteczko. That is to say, a private Polish town which belongs to a nobleman, to a member of the Polish Shlachta, of Polish nobility. We call these people the magnates. And it is primarily this particular arrangement where the town belongs to a magnate that the conceptualization of shtetl takes its roots.
Okay, so how did then did the shtetl, this sounds almost like a cooperative, how did the shtetl develop? When did people say stop living in towns, dorfs, or cities and then find themselves in shtetls?
Most of the Jews in the 17th, 18th, and early 19th century East Europe live not in the cities and not in the villages. They live in the shtetlach, in these private Polish towns. The story goes like follows. About 700 years ago, when the Polish kings allowed Jews to settle in Poland, they gave them rights to settle in towns and cities, mostly under crown control. And around late 15th, early 16th century, the local Catholic Church and the burghers, who really cannot compete with the Jewish merchants on the marketplace, decided to get for their cities a special privilegia, a special privilege, a special status, which is called de non tolerandi Judeos. That is to say, we do not tolerate Jews within the walls in the town. It was religiously framed but economically oriented privilege for the Christians in town, and Jews had to move from these big cities elsewhere. At that very point, Poland becomes one of the biggest, if not the biggest, countries of Europe, and the expansion implies that the king gives towns as gifts to the magnates, and magnates become the owners of the towns. And, of course, they need the infrastructure to be in place. They need trade. They need vodka production to be in place and many other industries to be there. and there is nothing there. So who would be doing, who will be taking care of all that? They think the Jews, the most mobile part of the population. So the Jews move from these big cities in central Poland to the private Polish towns that would later be called Shtetlech, in eastern Poland, in Lithuania, in what today is Lithuania, Belarus, and Ukraine. This is how things came to place.
Okay. What does the word Pale of Settlement mean? You also hear this is an American expression, outside the pale, which refers to being outside the Pale of Settlement. What was the Pale of Settlement, Yohanan Petrovsky?
Right. It's a nice expression, outside the Pale. Outside the Pale also means that you are outside some of the imposed restrictions. The Pale of Settlement is the formerly Polish territory, which had been captured by Russia in course of the Polish partitions between 1772 and 1795. And this territory now, in the late 18th century, is no more Polish. It is already Russian. And Russia looks at this territory, which is its new western borderland, and asks a question. Well, what do we do? Before 1772, no Jews were allowed into the Russian Empire. Just no. No Jews, period. Now we inherited these huge territories, which represent 66% of the former Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth territory. So what do we do with these 1 million Jews that we inherited with these territories? We can banish them, but actually we cannot. It's physically impossible. On the other hand, we can legalize their presence, but let us allow the Jews to live just on these territories. So these territories in the western side of the Russian Empire, formerly Polish territories, now become what they call the Pale of Jewish Settlement. That is to say, the territory where Jews are legally allowed to settle within the boundaries of the Russian Empire. And these territories have established provinces. There are 15 provinces, and they constitute this institution. It's not just the territory, but it's the entire set of laws, regulations that we would call administrative institution, the Pale of Jewish Settlement.
Uh-huh. My bubby, my grandmother, was born in a small shtetl in what she described as northern Poland. It was called Czarna. I don't know if you know about the city Czarna. That's how she pronounced it, whether what it's called today in modern Polish or Russian. But she spoke six languages. She spoke Polish instead from Yiddish. She spoke Yiddish, Polish, Ukrainian, Lithuanian, Russian. I asked her, why do you speak so many languages? And she said, well, it really depended on what day of the week as to what country I was living in. Because sometimes she was living, she never moved, but sometimes she was living in Poland, sometimes she was living in Lithuania, sometimes she was living in Russia. What was the deal with that? What was going on politically with this, with the back and forth with these shtetlach in the Pale of Shtetl, Pale of Settlement, Jochen and Petrovsky Stern?
Most likely your grandmother lived not in northern part of the Pale of Settlement, but it's in central part. Somewhere on the territory between what today is Ukraine, Belarus, and Poland. And this territory changed hands many times in the course of the 20th century. It could be in Czechoslovakia, or in Hungary, or in Ukraine, or in the Soviet Union, or in the Austrian Empire, or in the independent Poland. Especially the region behind the Carpathian Mountains, so the so-called Transcarpathia, would change hands very often between 1917 and 1939, I would say 1945. In addition to that, the town Czarna, which simply means the black one, can be anywhere. If you open this famous gazetteer published by Selyansak and Mokotov, which is called Where Once We Walked, I'm sure you'll find quite a number of shtetlach called Czarna, the black one. Chorny in Russian or Ukrainian. It is very difficult to locate it on the map unless you know where it, in what province it was situated.
Where it was near. Yeah, my aunt actually went back about a decade ago, and she said she wished she hadn't because she was just like, it was full of Polish peasants who really weren't interested in having Jews come and visiting them and taking the houses back that they had stolen. But that's for another time.
An interesting story. That's an interesting story, Reverend Herschel, by the way. People coming back and not finding their towns and place. The moment Jews were out from many of these territories and from many of these towns, the towns really transformed themselves from towns into villages. So it means that the Jews were really not only the backbone of the economy, but they were the only urbanizers in these territories.
Mm-hmm. Now, I imagine the shtetl as being like these little, like, one-street towns where it was a dirt road and it had, like, a store for where people would, like, maybe buy general merchandise or just a little tiny nothing of a place. How big would you say the shtetls were?
Let me get back to your wonderful description of the shtetl, which is very often to be found in the memoirs and in the belles lettres.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, many people imagine the shtetl as a small Jewish village with a majority of Jewish population, with one dirt street, with a kerosene store, in the middle of nowhere, in the godforsaken place of the world, where nothing happens but pogroms, and Jews are extremely poor here. This is a pretty much accurate image of some, but not of all, of the shtetl late in the 1930s. But even in that particular period, most shtetl would be big towns. Now, you're asking an important question, how big is the shtetl? Well, I'm looking at the shtetl in what I call the age of its glory, late 18th, early 19th century, about 50, 70 years that I define as the golden age shtetl, and I found what the Russian administrators in care of these new territories also found at the time. They found that the statistics doesn't tell you anything, because most of the shtetl that we know and that you can list, you know, momentarily just thinking about that particular part of the world, most of the shtetl didn't have the majority of Jewish population. They had sometimes 40%, sometimes 60%, but in most cases not more than 60% of Jewish population.
Wait a minute. Excuse me just a second. You're busting now. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Yochanan Petrovsky Stern. You're busting now another myth, because I always imagined that since it's called a shtetl, and a shtetl is a Yiddish word, that these towns were pretty much exclusively Jewish, and they had like a small area for the non-Jews, because everybody, you need like a Shabbos person to come and light your stove or take your cholent off the stove or whatever like this. So here it is, you're shattering another myth that for the most part, these areas which were the Pale of Settlement, which was where Jews were relegated, were still a minority.
Let me tell you this. Yes, I'm doing just that. I'm debunking the myths. But I am not to blame for that. I'm taking the contemporary documents, very careful descriptions, the inventories on the Russian side and inventage on the Polish side, and they give you a pretty accurate description of what is going on there. And all of them give you the numbers. 45% of Jewish population, 47% of Jewish population, 51% of Jewish population. There is never 95%. It just doesn't happen at the time, which means that perhaps something else needs to be taken into consideration for us to think of the shtetl as a Jewish town. And I'm not saying this is a wrong description. I'm just saying we have to look elsewhere. And when I start looking at what the Jews do in the shtetl, not who they are in the shtetl, not how many Jews there are in the shtetl, but what they actually do, the situation changes radically. And that is a chiddush. That is one of the important things that I'm bringing into the fore. And I'm saying, yes, correct. Jews are never the majority in the shtetl, neither in the 19th, neither in the 80s, nor in the 19th century. But if you go to the marketplace, if you make a list of the tavern keepers in town, if you make a list of the guild merchants in town, if you make a list of the people who are active in international trade, you will get astonishing figures. 90%, 95% of all the people who trade in the marketplace and who own the stores in the marketplace are the Jews. 99% of the second and third guild merchants, that is to say, a special status within the hierarchy of merchants in the Russian Empire, they are Jewish. 90% of all the artisans, barrel makers, hat makers, tailors, shoemakers, in any shtetl are the Jews. So which means that Jews are overrepresented in what can be called the driving mechanism of the shtetl, the economic well-being of the shtetl, that is where the Jews are overrepresented. And from that perspective, of course, the shtetl is a Jewish town. So I'm emphasizing not how many Jews are in the shtetl, but what do Jews do in the shtetl. I'm emphasizing verbs and not nouns.
Gotcha. Understood. I mean, it was surprising to me. I mean, one of the early part in the book you devote to Jewish smuggling because of the Russians' perception of, I guess, maybe xenophobia or whatever it was through the Tsar Catherine and her successors, that they wanted to keep Western influences out, France, et cetera, and so they closed the border to unnecessary French luxuries. And there's a story involving Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, and Berdichev is a major city in this area that you're talking about.
Right.
Again, I imagine Berdichev as just being some little town with a road in the middle of it, and from your description of it, it was probably quite a large city, even though it was still called a shtetl. The story goes is that the head of the town, Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, who was the town rabbi, went to the town smuggler and asked for 3 yards of black silk because he wanted to make a new kapata for himself. This is on the day before Passover. And I was always imagining that, where is it being smuggled from? Since you're talking silk, and it's I know that China is at odds with Russia for hundreds of years, for centuries, that it must be it's Chinese silk which is being smuggled. Yet, I look at your book, it's probably most likely the silk was coming from Paris. So what was the deal with smuggling things this whole culture and economy with Jewish smugglers, Jochanan Petrovsky Stern?
Let me tell you this. Jews were not the only smugglers, but Jews were mostly the smugglers in that particular area at that particular time, late 18th, early 19th century, for three reasons. First, because they had been for centuries the international merchants who are purchasing the commodities in Paris, and in northern Italy, and bringing them through Leipzig, sometimes through Danzig, sometimes through Prague, of course through Lemberg, Lviv, Lvov, and brought it to Berdichev. Berdichev, on the other hand, is, of course, not a small town. Berdichev has 35,000 people at the time. It's a very big town, even a city from our perspective, but it is still a shtetl because it is a private Polish town until the 1860s. It is in the hands of the Count of the Prince Radziwill. So it is a private Polish town, even though it is on the Russian territory. Now, once Russia realizes that people who are purchasing the commodities and bring them from France to Russia are actually helping Russia to feed the French Revolution, they don't like that. And Catherine the Great decides to close the border, and she imposes restrictive tariffs on any kind of import. But it means that people cannot get the commodities. It means that Levi Yitzchak cannot buy for himself any silk to have his new kapota. It means that women cannot have ribbons, they cannot have corduroy, they cannot have any kind of velvet for their nice dresses. You know, when I'm given lectures on the book, I have PowerPoint presentation, and illustrating the importance of smuggling at the time, I'm showing the colorful colored pictures of Jewish women from Galicia and from the Pale of Settlement made in the mid-19th century. And when you look at these pictures, you will be amazed. Everything which is on these women, every bit of cloth that these women have on themselves, all these things are made of the smuggled goods, because none of these goods, none of these commodities, none of these types of textile can be bought in the internal Russia. All of that is smuggled from Austria, France, Prussia into the Russian Empire. So, which means that Jews are really functioning in a very interesting perspective as people who provide you with commodities otherwise outlawed by the state. You want to be fashionable, you want to look nice, go to a Jewish smuggler. So it really changes the perception of Jews as people of trade and, of course, creates links between Jews and fashion, and also between Jews and illegal activities. Illegal activities that benefit rank-and-file people, but piss off the government.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If you're just joining us, we are talking with Dr. Professor Yochanan Petrovsky Stern from Northwestern University. Wrote a book, The Golden Age Shtetl, A New History of Jewish Life in East Europe. We're talking about the shtetl and trying to debunk most of, as many as we can in the short period of time, the myths that go with it. One of the myths that maybe it's not a myth, but it is, you can tell me if it is a myth, is that all the Jews in the shtetl, because the shtetl was such a pressure cooker environment, that everybody was religious. Everybody kept Shabbos, and all the women went to the mikveh, and everybody kept kosher, and all the boys went to cheder, went to the proper Jewish schools. Is that true or is that myth? Just like a game show, truth or myth.
Let me tell you this. If you think about the Jews of the shtetl as the black yarmulke, yeshivish type of congregants of one of the Brooklyn synagogues, that would be a mistake. Of course, Jews have smugglers. Of course, Jews have criminals.
That's business.
Jews have gangsters. All of that is there. But all these people, until the mid-19th century, in any particular shtetl, they have one of the same set of values. They do not have Reform Judaism. They do not have Conservative Judaism. They have some people who are more secular, some people who are less secular. They have Jews who would perhaps travel over Shabbat on a wagon when nobody sees them. They have Jews who would then go to the synagogue and put on kapota and look like they are really, you know, ultra-Orthodox. You have men who are chasing after married women. You have quite a bit of promiscuity in the shtetl. However, all these people have one and the same set of values, which is called traditional Judaism. They have nothing else but that. Mm-hmm. Secularism as a concept is not there. Liberal trends in Judaism are not there. So, of course, there is a small yeshiva. Not in every shtetl, but some shtetlach would have a small yeshiva with 3-4 boys, not more than that. You would have perhaps 5, 15, 25, depending on the size of the shtetl, Hasidic shtiblach, where you can go and pray with a Hasidic quorum, with a Hasidic minion. You would have a major synagogue in town, which is most likely Ashkenazic, that is a Litvish synagogue, and that would perhaps be the only religious division between the people. But they are following different paths, and of course, nobody is trying to tell them what to do or how conduct their businesses, although, of course, the rabbi all the time tries to impose some more rigid rules on what cannot be done on the market days and how people can or cannot trade with non-Jews. But in most cases, the shtetlach live according to the mercantile principle, which means that the economic benefit prevails and the religious concerns are put aside.
Mm-hmm. What brought about the downfall of the shtetl paradigm, that you had mass waves of Jews leaving that part of Europe from the 1880s to the 1920s?
You know, you will be amazed. Most people who are leaving Europe with a wave of the Great Migration after the, I would say, late 1870s and up to 1924, most of these people are not coming from the shtetl. Most of these people are coming from big cities. You have to be well-informed to be able to move. You have to have startup money to be able to move. You have to have the passport bureau where you can get your foreign passport to be able to move. This is not what is happening in the shtetl. Most shtetl people are still there. However, the migration from the shtetl and the decline of the shtetl starts not with the attempts of the Jews in the shtetlach to move to the west, but with the attempts of the Jews in the shtetlach to move to the big cities. And this happens in course of the East European urbanization proletarianization of the masses, and of course industrialization of the Russian Empire and of Poland, which is at that time part of the Russian Empire. Industrialization and urbanization are two things that kill the shtetl. I'll give you one example. You suddenly have in the second half of the 19th century huge footwear manufacturing industries in Odessa and huge textile industries and ready-made clothes industries in Lodz in Poland, right? Which means that a person, instead of going to a tailor or to a shoemaker asking for a pair of shoes or for a coat to be made, goes to a store and gets everything ready-made. That is something that makes the life of Jewish artisans in the shtetl absolutely miserable. They cannot compete with big business.
Uh-huh. It's like that's the malls moving to the suburbs and killing those little mom-and-pop shops.
Right. So, and where do these artisans go? They need to abandon their businesses, and they move to big cities where they become blue-collar workers, hired workers. Forget about Shabbat. They have 7 days working week. They work 17 hours per day, and so on and so forth. That is the beginning of the decline of the shtetl and the proletarianization of the Jewish masses, something that would bring thousands and thousands of impoverished Jews into the embrace of the Bund, of the Jewish Marxist Socialist Party in East Europe. And that would actually make the shtetl lose its economically most active and most vibrant and most promising constituents.
Mm-hmm. Understood. We're running out of time, so I just have one question for you, if we can. It's 1825. And you, Yochanan Petrovsky Stern, have a choice of where you want to live anywhere in Eastern Europe, from Poland all the way to Moscow. Where would you choose to live? What would be the best place for a Jew to be?
Let me tell you, Moscow and also St. Petersburg are far beyond the pale. They are really beyond the pale. And to be there, I have to be a very wealthy merchant, which I have no desire to be. So physically, in 1825, I have no chance to be in Moscow or St. Petersburg. Also, Warsaw does not allow Jews in. There are some hundred Jews of Warsaw living there, also very wealthy and privileged Jews. Other Jews live on the other side of the River Vistula in a special Jewish district called Praga. But I would go to live in Vilna or in Berdychev. I would prefer Berdychev. This is where the marketplace is vibrant. This is where a lot of education, a lot of interesting trends in education are taking place. This is where the Hasidic courts are established, and so on and so forth. I would like to be in Berdychev.
Okay, very good. That's going to wrap it up for us again. Our guest has been Yochanan Petrovsky Stern. He's a professor of Judaic Studies at Northwestern University. Just wrote a book, The Golden Age, Shtetl, A New History of Jewish Life in Eastern Europe, published by Princeton University Press, available on Amazon and everywhere, wherever else good books are found. Thank you so much, Yochanan, for coming in and enlightening us about the shtetl.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. I found that really enlightening and fascinating. We have coming up in a couple of weeks something we refer to as the 3 weeks, which commemorates the destruction of the First and Second Temples and other tragedies and disasters that have befallen the Jewish people historically. And there's some really pretty music that describes that period of time. But during that period of time, we don't listen to music. So we go back to the a cappella stuff. So I thought it would be worth our endeavors if we played Ari Kunstler, who was a folk singer, playing Im Eshkechach, which is a verse based on a verse, which is a verse, "If I forget you, Jerusalem, let my right hand wither," and let's just listen to it. Assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale. Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. I just find out, actually, that the Golden Age Shtetl by Yochanan Petrovsky Stern is nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for Best Nonfiction for 2014. That's way awesome. So, yeah, it's a fascinating read. It really is. A myth buster. Coming up next, we have, for your listening pleasure, this is the Klezmer Fusion Band from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And this is called Russian Share, the Russian Tune. It's just for you. Mm-hmm.
Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Hey, Herschel Fittman here. We got time for one more song. This is an instrumental. It's from the CD Strings of the Soul, and this song is called Ben Bog Bog, which is an upbeat and lively tune.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Herschel Fineman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. The portion of the week is the portion of Pinchas that can be found in the book of Numbers, chapters 24 and following. But we're not going to talk about it. Instead, I have never done this before on the Jewish Hour. I'm going to read an article. This appears on Aish.com. It's written by Sarah Yocheved Rigler, and it's entitled, Were Our Prayers in Vain? An aftermath, an afterthought of the 3 young yeshiva students who were murdered this last week. And she writes, Tisha B'Av came early this year. The whole Jewish people is plunged into mourning, a mourning as deep as our hopes were high, as dark as our prayers in unity were bright. Monday night, just before Rebbetzin Tzipora Heller's weekly class in my home, I was putting out cold water in cups. Riva, one of the students, came close to me and whispered to my ear, "I had dinner with someone from the Prime Minister's office. There's going to be bad news." I looked at her quizzically and went to the computer, and there I saw that they weren't using the word boys anymore. Now they were using the word bodies. I screamed in anguish. I had thought they were alive. I thought they were being held as hostages, kept safety for a prisoner exchange. I collapsed into tears of shock and grief. When I collected myself enough to go into the living room, I found Rebbetzin Heller sitting with her head in her hand and 20 women weeping. One of the students offered the information that the boys were found in a field 10 minutes away from the place where they had kidnapped, and they were most likely murdered immediately or within the first hour. They were already dead before we even know they had been abducted? Before prayers throughout the world stormed heaven with their safe return? Before Jews of every religious and political stripe? They were already dead before we even knew they were abducted? Before prayers throughout the world stormed heaven for their safe return? Before Jews of every religious and political stripe united in a way we have not seen in years? Before the three mothers appeared at the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva pleading for support? Before 15,000 Israeli soldiers not much older than the boys themselves spent 2 weeks without sleep or showers combing every basement and tunnel beneath the terrorist stronghold of Hebron? They were already butchered, their young bodies lying in a shallow grave miles north from the search area. And in the ocean of our mourning, a question rises up like a sea monster. Were our prayers and our good deeds and our unity in vain? My friend Tamar lived with her family in Colombia. Her older brother, married with two children, was kidnapped. The kidnappers demanded $1 million ransom. Tommy's father scraped together the funds and paid the ransom, but her brother was never returned. 6 months later, they learned from a man kidnapped together with her brother who escaped that the kidnappers had murdered her brother before the ransom was ever paid. With our prayers and good deeds, Rabbi David Aaron, teaching a series about prayer, exclaimed, "Jews don't pray." The word prayer comes from a Latin word meaning to beg. The problems inherent is that concepts of prayer are that we don't have to tell God what we need because God is omniscient. And it is futile to try to change God's mind, because God always gives us what he knows is best for us. On the other hand, the Hebrew word for appealing to God is hitpalel. It is a reflexive verb indicating that one is acting on oneself. Through our prayers, we don't change God. Rather, we change ourselves. Since God always gives us as much good as we can contain, through prayer for tefillah, we make ourselves into bigger vessels to contain God's blessings. No one can doubt about the 18 days of prayer, good deeds, and radiant unity not seen in years. The Jewish people is bigger than it was before this frightful night. We are changed. We have transformed from a bickering tribe to united family. For 18 days, our hearts beat in unison. Our prayers were not an appeal, rejected, but a force of love so hot that it melted the iron walls between us, a wind of yearning so strong that it blew off the mask of camouflage our truest selves. But what of Ayal, Naphtali, and Gilad? According to Judaism, the soul of one killed for being a Jew rises to higher levels in the world of truth, the spiritual realms where souls go when they exit the physical body. The suffering of Ayal, Naphtali, and Gilad ended at the moment of death. Their luminous souls are enjoying the spiritual bliss reserved for those whose great feats in life or martyr's death have earned them a closeness to God in the world of eternity. And we, the families of the boys, their friends, their neighbors, and all of us, are left to suffer their loss, to mourn the tragedy of their young lives cut short. Our Bible tells us that there is a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance. Tisha B'Av came early this year. It is time to weep and it's a time to mourn. But we can only hold on to the unity we achieve in these 18 days. Then it's the merit of the redemption will come, and it will finally be a time to dance. What else can we say? We're going to take a quick commercial break and be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Spex Howard from the Spex Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for The Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. If you want to get in touch with me, the way to do that, rabbifinman.com, RABBIFINMAN.com. You'll find right on the homepage a contact us link. Send me something, an inquiry, a comment, a criticism. That's also very good. Good things. And I read all my email personally and answer it personally. So no automated responses, none of that. You get it in real time. You'll also find archived editions of the radio show. Miss something from last week's show or the week before when we had Rabbi Tlushkin or the week before when we had Cantor Smolash or the week before that? Well, rabbifinman.com. You catch up on the last 5 weeks. By the way, you'll also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and jcastnetwork.org. You'll also find yours truly conveying information in hopefully an entertaining way on the eParsha page, the uParsha page, the Hasidic U Story. They're all there. And, of course, the very important donations page. We're in July. We didn't pay for June. We didn't make it this month, folks. So we're sending out the appeals big time, heavy. They're very patient here at the station. But I have to pay the piper if I'm going to play the show. And I can only play the show if you guys come through. So go to the rabbifinman.com. Go on the donations page. Click a number. It's all through PayPal. It's all very safe, secure. If you don't trust internet for paying bills, that's fine. Making donations, that's fine. Send your contribution to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. At this point, I would say I'm getting two-thirds of my donations are coming in via the net, and a third are still coming in at 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. So they all work. Everything works. It's good. And just as long as we keep on doing it, The Jewish Hour, which is now 18 years on air, will continue for another at least 18 years on air. The story which I wanted to convey involved a person by the name of Chaim, who was a tailor. And he lived in a shtetl. And the shtetl was owned by the Paritz, was the magnate, who one day walked into his tailor symposium, emporium, which is nothing more than his shack, and said, I need 200 uniforms by Friday. Can you do it? And he just said, his wife, who was a very shrewd woman, said, yes, we can do it. So he said, how in the world are we going to be able to do it? He said, it's simple. We'll go right now. We'll get all the measurements for the uniforms. We'll travel all night to Leipzig to the fair. We will buy the material. We'll travel back. We'll work day and night until Friday. We will be able to knock out 200 uniforms. Fine. Good. So they go to, this is the plan. They wind up in Leipzig, and it's like 6 o'clock in the morning. The market doesn't open until 8, so they take a room in an inn to be able to get some sleep. And he says, listen, I really have to go do my morning prayers with a minion in the synagogue. She says, don't get lost. I know you. So as it turned out, he went to the synagogue, and it was the rabbi who was leading the prayers in honor of the passing of his father, who was some sort of saintly man. And after the prayers, there was vodka and herring and cake and stories about the man who had passed away, and Chaim is just lost, and it's 8 o'clock, it's 9 o'clock, it's 9:30. His wife is about to have apoplexy. She storms into the shul and says, Chaim, we got to go. And he says, where do we got to go? And she says, don't you remember? We have to go to the fair. She says, what do we have to go to the fair for? She says, what are you, an idiot? We have to go buy fabric. She says, what do we need to buy fabric for? She says, we have to go make the uniforms. He says, what do we need to make uniforms for? She says, I can't believe I'm living with you. We have to make the uniforms so that this Paritz will pay us. And he says, and what will be when the Paritz pays us? She goes, ugh. She thinks, then we'll be happy. And he says, you have to travel all night and go to the fair and buy material and travel all the way back and work day and night. And so the Paritz can pay us and then you'll be happy. I'm happy right now. That which you're listening to behind us is, unfortunately, the prayers of the comrades, the friends of the three boys who were who were killed. This is at their funeral. After the burial was complete, they're singing El Vino Malcano, Our Father, Our King, There's None Like You. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. Have a great day. Have a great week. Take care.